Project Lawful aka Plane Crash by Yarwane aka Eliezer Yudkowsky and Lynn Tamande. My fun research project has more existential risk than I anticipated. Episode 133.
Pull timestamp, day 19, 15, afternoon.
Well, that sure was a fascinating lunch discussion full of interesting topics and questions, some actually pretty basic questions, mostly relayed through Ioni. Keltham has definitely learned the important fact that he needs to actually back off and not try to plunge the new candidates directly into the same classes as the current hires. But it's not a failed experiment. The plan failed, yes, the hope failed, but the experiment itself is just data. Keltham now has four basic phases to cram into his limited supply of days and hours, and they are teaching law to the current hires, including some keeper-only classes, overseeing the current hires teaching the new candidates, doing science, to acid synthesis, spell silver refining, roads, medicine, and all other important subjects. Having a personal life including wizard practice, scroll practice, also now learning martial arts from security, and dating Carissa, Yesa, Maritzel, Iona, and Asmodia. This would be a really good time to be a sufficiently advanced wizard that he'd only need to sleep 2 hours per night. But that, apparently, is not within the cards for a while. The thought occurs to Keltham that, at this rate, he may end up participating in his first threesomes and orgies, rather earlier than those would usually come, in the natural course of increasing sexual complication, just for scheduling reasons.
I think alternating days is a good idea for the law lectures anyway. I've seen lots of the girls staying up late, going back over the notes, and having more time probably lets things sink in more. I have no idea how to help you with your sex life. I guess perhaps you would benefit from having it pointed out that you don't have to, like, do a whole evening date every time and can also just pull someone aside for a blowjob at lunchtime. I don't know if that'd actually feel like keeping up with your personal life more.
Yeah, at some point I'm going to have to slow down and ask myself what I really want, whether I'm really getting it, and what the whole point is. But not now. Maybe after I'm dating a few more girls. Anyways, he's going to go hang his spell for the day, get in some scroll practice.
PL timestamp, day 19, 15, middle afternoon.
Talk to Chelish experts about agriculture and plant breeding, to see if they're missing anything there he can plausibly quickly fix.
PL timestamp. Day 19, 15, dinner.
Have dinner with all the researchers. Show the newcomers where Doth Ilan is located inside its universe.
PL timestamp, day 19, 15, evening.
And spend his evening making extensive use of Yaisa. Tonight is the 7-day anniversary of their first week's arrangement, for 25 gold per week, including Keltham having control of certain things. How's she feeling about continuing that arrangement indefinitely? NSFW. To be clear, Yaisa has not been authorized any orgasms at any point in the last week, has been used only occasionally, and has sometimes been given assignments. This morning, for example, Keltham told her to spend the whole day playing with herself, without coming, when not otherwise occupied, and maybe if he felt like it, he'd let her come this evening, on their 1-week anniversary. As of asking her this question about continuing their arrangement, Keltham apparently hasn't felt like it yet. To be clear, Keltham feels like Yaisa should have a fair look at what she might be getting into here. At least, that's what his brain firmly claims is the reason why he's being so mean to poor Yaisa. Also, to be clear, there's been an additional 2 days that Keltham doesn't know about inside Yaisa's existence.
Yaisa is in favor. She thought about whether she could demand more money from Keltham because he clearly thinks he's being very mean to her, but she doesn't think she could say under fairness she ought to get more money. Not really.
He's pretty happy about that. Happy enough, even, to let Yaisa. Apparently he's not that happy. Yet, it just feels weirdly wrong and awful that Yaisa might think she was owed an orgasm, that she'd deserved or earned one if they start off their relationship this way. That Yaisa might start expecting orgasms on future celebratory occasions or anniversaries, and feeling wronged if she doesn't get one. Keltham probably wants to see this girl come again at some point, but is weirdly afraid of doing that tonight. Keltham briefly considers whether to force his brain into doing this anyways, but backs off. He doesn't think you're supposed to refrain from doing things you might have enjoyed, out of fear of where it might take one's relationship. But he is uncertain of himself still, and there is also a heuristic against forcing yourself to do things you feel afraid of doing. He can always make Yaisa come next time, when it'll definitely actually be just because he feels like it, and not because he owes it to her, or that's an informal rule of their relationship. He should tell Carissa about that part later. Probably Carissa will be happy. At least Keltham is guessing so, anyways. Carissa is always happy when... Well, it feels sometimes like Carissa is always happy when Keltham is cruel to somebody. But it's presumably more that she's happy that Keltham is being evil and learning to do what he himself wants. That Keltham is discovering his own sexuality. And that Keltham is being more the way that Carissa hopes he'll be towards her. Keltham will, of course, ask Yaisa explicitly whether he's allowed to tell Carissa about how he's being mean to Yaisa, for that information is also Yaisa's. He won't mention his private wobbliness about the direction Carissa is taking him.
She pouts thoughtfully. Yes, if you sometimes give me secret gossip on what's up with you and Carissa so I can smirk knowingly when the new kids repeat ridiculous rumors.
Keltham will ask Carissa for authorization about that and get back to Yaisa. Are these rumors theoretical, or...
No, there are totally lots of rumors about Carissa. Like that she was created from scratch by the gods to be perfect for Keltham. That's one that Yaisa's heard. Or that Asmodeus himself chose Carissa to drop Keltham on. Or that Abigail gave Carissa to Keltham as a slave. Or that Carissa is pregnant with Keltham's child.
The project decided that it was better if Keltham knew some things consistent with someone thinking of Carissa as chosen by Asmodeus, just in case some hidden correlate of that ever came to his attention.
Oh, right. He should actually schedule some alter selves to take place where he can see them. Yaisa okay with doing that tomorrow? He probably won't date her tomorrow, but it doesn't need to be a date, just a quick switch where Keltham can see it. Carissa wasn't created from scratch by the gods for Keltham. It's nearly certain that whatever force selected Keltham to arrive in this universe did so in a way that very strongly matched him and Carissa to each other, and selected Carissa for him to land on. If anything, from a local perspective, it's more like they should see Keltham as having been created from scratch for Carissa. Keltham's got no idea if those forces explicitly negotiated with Asmodeus. Keltham would guess no on the explicit negotiations, but yes on Asmodeus and the other gods rapidly figuring out what was going on and making decisions that would have contributed to the tropes selecting this place for his landing, including some things that the gods would only do if the Keltham steering forces looked to be sufficiently beneficial for them. Or if for some weird reason Asmodeus would have tried to shut down the whole thing, if Keltham had landed on anybody who wasn't attractive to the Queen of Cheliax, then Keltham could have landed on Carissa, at least in part for that reason. But the Keltham steering forces might have needed to predict Asmodeus doing a lot in exchange, to serve whatever goals Asmodeus was able to deduce predictably to the steerers from seeing how Keltham had been steered already. Negotiations like that don't have to be explicit when you're a god. What's slave? Keltham heard Yaisa use that term before, and he can tell from context that it's a sex thing, but not the details.
Yaisa didn't follow that, but probably someone was taking notes, and the anxious genius types will puzzle over it later. Whatever. A slave is a person who is wholly the possession of another. If you're really hardcore about it, regarded by civilization itself as their property, as much as their shoes are. Yaisa is not herself that hardcore. Lots of people use it just for aesthetically reminiscent relationships that didn't involve paying. Civilization to go along with this. When you call someone slave in bed, you're not necessarily bringing in the whole thing, just the thing that's hot about it. Probably Keltham is now going to have a million questions. Yaisa can't answer because her exposure to this concept is all from disrecommended romance novels titled Slave of a Barbarian, and so on.
Yeah, that's been mentioned to him as something he might want to negotiate with the government of Cheliax about, though only at the point where Keltham wants that for his own sake, and he's not quite there yet. Is the queen just gives Carissa to Keltham as a slave, Something that especially seems within the realm of plausibility?
No, it's completely ridiculous. So is, Carissa was created wholesale by the gods. People don't come up with rumors because they're plausible. They come up with them because they're fun to whisper and tend to make other people say, scandalized, no, that couldn't possibly be, but then doubt themselves because they're on Project Lawful. And, like, it'd be true most places, so it has that for credibility. Some places have kind of a lot of slavery. Not that Yaisa wants to have that conversation, which does not sound hot at all.
He's confused, but will queue it up on his Carissa questions list. Actually, he should be heading off to bed about now anyways. Sleep well, Yaisa. NSFW, and spend an hour teasing yourself in the morning. Keltham's probably not going to use her that day, to be clear. Keltham is just being mean. Oh, that thought seems to have turned him on again. Well, he can make some quick additional use of Yaisa before he heads off to bed.
PL timestamp, day 19, 15, night.
Keltham repairs to his bedroom, from his cuddle room, and asks security to drop Carissa a note to come by if she has a moment. Only if she's really got a moment, though. Yes, Keltham understands that he's got the ability to give her orders, if he wants to. He just wants there to be actually in practice, a way for him to give her less than maximum priority requests. It's too nerve-wracking the other way.
Then she'll make him wait for 15 minutes while she reviews the Yaisa transcripts and tries to make sure the stuff about God negotiations doesn't translate to anything new and important. She thinks it doesn't, for once, though they should put it in the report to the Grand High Priestess in case she's wrong. Then she'll change into sleeping clothes, since Carissa, who doesn't have a ring of sustenance, was about to go to bed and go find her boyfriend.
Keltham possibly looks slightly sleepy. A healthy teenager who's previously had a lot of Dathalani healthcare can pull a lot of 14-hour days. It is a thing that is within the capability of a teenage human body, but he may start to look a little worn at some point. Keltham wants to share a thing about Yaisa with Carissa. Yaisa says yes, but wants secret gossip about him and Carissa so that she can look knowing when the newcomers repeat weird rumors. Yes, no, Keltham should make decisions like this himself, but it's fine to ask Carissa if she has input, or Keltham should make all those future decisions unilaterally, without asking Carissa for any input at all.
I won't be hurt if you decide unilaterally, but as you decided to ask, yes, that's fine. Though also, I copied some spells off Lady Avaricia after dinner in exchange for some interesting tidbits about myself, so the gossip may be less valuable than Yaisa hoped.
Keltham will share his sexy Yaisa details then.
Sounds like someone's having fun.
Hopefully two people are having fun, but her price would have gone up if she wasn't, or so I hope. I'll just remember to ask her that explicitly at some point. He'll also tell Carissa about the Carissa rumors. Repeat what he told Yaisa about divine pseudo-negotiations after the fact. And ask why there would be a lot of slaves in other countries and Yaisa wouldn't want to talk about that. Are they doing this particular form of perversion dreadfully wrong outside of Chiliax? It sure does look like something that could go horribly wrong, as Keltham has thought on multiple occasions.
In a lot of places, when you conquer a place in war, you take the people there as slaves, as payment to the soldiers for their work in fighting the war. In general, this custom replaced the custom of killing them. I wouldn't expect Yaisa to know this, but my best guess is that slave, sexy sense, came from people looking at slaves, bad sense, and going, okay, but I'm sorry, that's really hot. Which is why people who are cautious of their phrasing, like Abigail, might say possession instead, so as not to mix them up in language. In more places than that, including parts of Chiliax, slavery can be a status for a person convicted of a serious crime against another person that justly denies them the protection of civilization and that they don't have the means to make right. Say I burned down your fields, the local temple might award me to you as compensation for the wealth I destroyed.
Okay, what's a slave when it's not a sexy thing? Or does somebody who burns somebody else's fields get awarded as a sex slave?
The word just means a person who has forfeited the protection of civilization and is the property of another. Usually you figure out with them what they're going to be obliged to do, and it's not too horrible because if it is, then they'll be like, well, fuck this and go right to hell, which you obviously aren't allowed to stop them from doing. Probably if your fields just got burned, you want a farmhand. But it's often a sex thing, because, unlike in Dathilan, where I'm getting the sense practically everyone would go, well, fuck this, and go straight to hell, at least half of people in Galerion will go, sure, beats having to wash all your dishes.
Do chaotic evil, or chaotic neutral, people ever get awarded as slaves? Those afterlives didn't sound so nice. Do neutral evil people ever get awarded as slaves?
Yes. Not in Cheliax, which gets very, very close to everyone to lawful, but yes. Like awaiting consumption, it's kind of something Carissa didn't expect Keltham would benefit from learning about. Also, selfishly, it seems likely to make him run screaming from the entire concept.
Yeah, it's okay. Dathalani know how to decouple between things and other things, which are not actually that thing. Message: if there's chaotic evil, chaotic neutral, or neutral evil people who were taken as slaves after their country lost a war, Galarian civilization and possibly Keltham are going to go in and replace governance inside the countries holding them at some point. Is this a fact that needs to not be spoken where Chelish governance can overhear it? Say, because it implies that civilization or Keltham will come into conflict with factions. Cheliax considers itself to be friendly with?
Message back. Messaging, because maybe at some point we'll need to do this for real, but not on this. Cheliax hasn't conducted a war of conquest in 300 years. Even when we were dysfunctional before the church came in, we weren't like that. I don't think any countries that meet that description are our allies at the World Wound, but even if they are, the World Wound Alliance would prohibit us attacking them there. Not for unrelated reasons, going to war with them, and certainly not permitting someone else to do that.
Okay, he should maybe go to sleep now. Please don't say things like forfeiting the protection of civilization. Civilization doesn't exist here, and if it did, it wouldn't think like that. Probably Galarian civilization won't think like it either. Even if it's mostly Keltham's, lawful evil instead of lawful good, it still won't think like that. He still hasn't gotten around to meeting any Intelligence 10 people at this point, but when he does, he strongly suspects that he should actually just not do that, shouldn't actually meet anybody with Intelligence 10. Not for a while. It's probably not good for his mental health if he starts thinking of the rest of Galarian as being inhabited by children, some of whom are being taken as slaves. Keltham's were children too, at some point, and needed protection themselves. Even from themselves. The concept that actual literal children would be taken or held as slaves has obviously not occurred to him at all.
I don't think they're much like children. And I wouldn't say they never need protection from themselves, but I think it's mostly a kind of protection you give them by making all the afterlives a soft place to land, not by trying to blunt all the edges of the world. But yeah, I do think they might seem like children to a Dathilani, so maybe you shouldn't meet them. And civilization here is going to have to be different here, to be something that functions with them if we don't just headband everybody.
They'll just headband everybody. Spellsilver doesn't look to be a kind of thing that civilization couldn't produce by the millions of tons if it felt like it. Good night, Carissa.
Good night. Carissa is very curious what Keltham will do once they headband all the people who are way below 10 intelligence and only get to 12 with the most expensive headband in the world, but now doesn't seem like the time for that conversation, and hopefully by the time that situation actually arises, Keltham will be eviler and think that enslaving all the stupid people is perfectly reasonable. They can shift all the planning around. We have avoided telling Keltham around slavery, and that could explode, to reflect that it'll only explode if he learns about Chelish slavery, or maybe slavery of children.
PL timestamp, day 19, 15, long night.
Carissa Sivar would really, really like to spend this night making glibness swords, but she should be responsible first. I'm here to request correction, if you have any.
If I'd found myself foolishly thinking clever-sounding thoughts about Hell's instructions to the Chosen, rather than Hell's instructions to myself, a slave of the Church, what are your thoughts about whether I should, in general, dare to speak to you of such? Hell's instructions to Church and Crown are suggestive that it may be Asmodeus's will that you come to comprehend his instructions to you for yourself, without such as myself presuming to instruct you on them. But perhaps my thoughts are foolish, and you will know them for such, and think something valuable in the process of refusing them.
Well, that sounds like a serious and important question of the kind Carissa can sense she's mostly been dodging for more immediate ones lately. She is doing a good job at her duties. The project is making interesting and valuable progress. Keltham does not seem suspicious. He's been corrupted a thoroughly respectable degree. Morale is high, and the markets on who will collapse aren't too pessimistic. She is not doing a particularly good job at the duty that Hell actually set her, to find in herself desires that have no place in Axis. She's definitely gotten eviler. She's pretty sure that running the project is about as lawful evil as an action can be. She is exercising power over other people to see the will of Asmodeus done, and trying to awaken in Keltham that which will let Hell claim him. She's being very evil. But the instruction wasn't just to be more evil. And it seems likely that the traits that make you rise in Hell are not just having done tons of evil things unhesitatingly as ordered, that she is not yet the right shape for the greatest of her ambitions. It does seem that Asmodeus intended her to find that path without steering by the church, or their instructions would have emphasized less not being proactive. But it seems to me that my current efforts to obey Hell's instructions to me are inadequate, she says carefully. So I would desire your thoughts on the principle that when I seem to be making little progress is a good time to seek out perspectives that might help me find my way.
Your efforts are incomplete. It's been less than 3 weeks since Hell instructed you. You are serving Asmodeus well in this world and being raised high within it. Keltham must be contained now. He must be corrupted on a time limit. If I thought you were wrong to prioritize the first line of your instructions, I would have advised you to take some time off your long nights and find somebody you hated enough to enjoy experimenting on, keeping in mind that you could name nearly anyone short of a count, and the crown would wrap them up and hand them over. But if you're really a good Asmodean, and I'm starting to think that you are, then you have relatively more time in which to do such things, is my own possibly foolish thought. You should not pass up obvious opportunities to make progress, for you should not dally on any of Hell's instructions, but you are allowed to prioritize. Your efforts may possibly be inadequate as well as incomplete, but it's not obvious to me that they are. They're clearly imperfect, but then, you're not Irori, and won't succeed in perfecting yourself without divine aid. You are, apparently, the sort of slave that needs to remember that and not think otherwise. There's a difference between knowing that you're falling short of perfection, as is worthy of some punishment even in a good slave, and failing to recognize the progress you've made as possibly making you not a bad slave, who might not be judged worthy of severe punishment. That judgment lies in the hand of your superior. To be clear, it is not your place to decide that you are doing not too badly. But you didn't leave that judgment to me. You called yourself inadequate. That was wrong of you, by the way. Jacinth slaps the chosen hard enough to hurt, but not very much compared to being lit on fire. Slaps don't do that. There, you've been punished.
I understand. Mostly, there's always a small discombobulation, a sense that there's something there Keltham would have questions about she couldn't answer. She tends to listen to that instinct, but she does not need to listen to it about this, because they are not going to tell Keltham anything like this, not for a long time. And when they do, he actually might have better instincts for it than she does.
The thought that I had, after seeing how much you couldn't be the one to decide your own punishments, well, it came to me while I was reviewing the transcript of what you said to the new candidates. About how, I forget your exact words, they might need to unlearn old habits of Cheliax and consider that you might be lawful enough that your words to them were actually true. It's forbidden to suggest out loud that your superiors are lying to you. It isn't wise to think it too much. And that makes it hard to notice or even imagine that what your superiors are saying is true. What if hell's instructions to you are not meant to work against your own interests? What if you're not Irori and can't succeed in perfecting yourself without divine aid? I think if you were to leave Asmodeus and walk the path of Irori, you would need to learn to punish yourself with only nothingness above you. And to survive that, if you could survive it at all, you would need to find the part of yourself that can never punish yourself enough if the judgment is left to your own hands and tear that out of your soul. Or you could leave your punishments to your superiors. Maybe it's not the case that you'd be better off with Irori, and you're not allowed to think that. Maybe Irori's way is actually not the best path for you. A path that you might have been tempted to punish yourself into walking if left to your own devices, but a path you cannot walk as yourself and remain whole. What if hell's instructions to you are not meant to work against your own interests? It is heretical to think otherwise. That may make it hard to notice when it is actually true. That was all of my foolish, clever thought.
Oh. Carissa feels slightly dizzy. It is strange to realize you were lying to yourself and hadn't noticed. Remember that you are not Irori is an instruction you would give to an Asmodean, whether or not they were like Irori, whether or not that path was one they could walk. Because, of course, walking it means not being Asmodean and possibly breaking within you that which makes you usable in hell. If anything, remember that you are not Irori is maybe an instruction you'd more give to an Asmodean who is capable of being like Irori, since otherwise, why not let them try and fail? But there is a good reason not to let Carissa try and fail, namely, that she's needed for this whole operation. And maybe Asmodeus doesn't actually want his useful servants smashed apart on the rocks of their own idiocy, so he warns them against it. And if they listen, good. And if they don't, then their destruction is wholly the product of their disobedience, which seems pleasing, somehow, to Carissa, in a way that is perhaps the shadow of how Asmodeus feels about it. Maybe she doesn't just need to learn to wield submission as a tool to entice Keltham. Maybe she actually needs to believe in it. How would she tell? Well, she could try it and see if she becomes more able to accomplish Asmodeus's goals. The fundamental assumption of Keltham's lecture this morning, that she's pretty sure half the students missed because he never stated it, so obvious it was to him, that going out and checking is the way to arrive at truth. Lots of smart people disagree with that. They argue that truth is found in mathematics, in logic, in theories, not in the mud where you never know anything for sure and have to do a lot of math just to guess how unsure you are. But Dath Ilan didn't even bother teaching it to their young children because it was so intrinsic to everything else. You go and check. Subirax is not a source of advice Carissa can use to figure out everything herself. Subirax is Carissa's superior, and the answer is what she says it is. Carissa doesn't actually understand why Asmodeus wishes it so, but she can feel the outlines of a reason, maybe, sort of, and she doesn't actually have to know. Carissa should not follow the path of Irori, not just because it would be disobedient, but because it wouldn't work. It would not make the project succeed and make Carissa someone who can fix even hell if she needs to. That might be right. Not Carissa's job, anyway, to assess if it's right. Subirax will tell her if she's doing better or doing worse.
I think you possibly are meant to assess whether I'm right, unfortunately for you, in the particular exact matter of interpreting the will of Asmodeus spoken by Hell to Carissa Savar. I don't think I'd have had my clever thought in 1,000 years if I hadn't read your transcript. Perhaps I'm still wrong or failing to see fully. I'm not smart enough, not lawful enough, that the chosen of Asmodeus should defer to me in a matter of understanding. But to whatever extent we do understand Asmodeus's instructions, even if it's because you told us so, the matter of how well you are doing in obeying them and how much you need be punished for deficiency is something that you must leave to your superiors. Trust to your superiors, even knowing they'll sometimes be less than perfect themselves because their judgments make what is right. Matters of Irori and Asmodeus I am only guessing upon. If you ever try to punish yourself as much as you think is needful, you'll destroy yourself. Of that, I'm now sure. I have no more advice or correction to offer you this night, Chosen. Your Third Circle Enchanter Assistant has arrived. The Queen confirms that she is pleased. Go with Asmodeus.
Carissa departs respectably like a reasonable person whose priorities are Asmodeus's. Glibness swords time. Glibness is that rare phenomenon, a sorcerer spell wizards can't cast. In general, one might expect there'd be lots of sorcerer spells wizards couldn't cast. After all, sorcery is inborn, sometimes from unions with bizarre magical creatures that themselves have abilities no wizard can replicate. In practice, this is very rare. Sorcerer spells tend towards configurations that a wizard, watching carefully, can see how one might emulate, and almost every sorcerer spell has eventually and painstakingly been found in a stable configuration that a wizard can build for themselves. Not so with Glibness. Glibness, to all appearances, doesn't have a stable configuration. It can only be cast spontaneously. You can never hang it on a scaffold. For this reason, there's a school of thought that argues song sorcerers, who can cast Glibness, aren't actually sorcerers at all. Carissa doesn't know much about that, but suspects it of being stupid, people trying to throw something that reflects their own weakness out of the category sorcerers, rather than understand it better. But the fact you can't scaffold Glibness doesn't mean you can't enchant a magic item with it. Enchanting a magic item with a spell usually requires casting the spell, but it's also technically possible, if trickier, to build the channels in the magic item scaffold through which the spell would flow if you cast it, without casting it. Many people don't do that because they're lazy and it's trickier, but it's not even that much trickier, unless you're also using a double scaffold so that you can get the project done faster, which, yes, admittedly, they are doing that here. And which does make it a smidge difficult, but not that hard. The other tricky element of what they're doing is putting Glibness in a sword. The standard way to do this would be a wondrous item, but Carissa doesn't have time to retrain, so she just invented a bunch of adaptations to arms and armor enchanting that make it work when you're doing something non-standard like this. Probably her assistant, who does have wondrous items training, can skip that part and just do it as a slotless charm. Does that all make sense?
Terrified newly assigned assistant enchanter, who wasn't briefed very much and is now certain he's going to die horribly. Yarwain, yes, chosen of Asmodeus. I will not fail you.
This is going to be so much fun.
She may notice at some point that the assistant enchanter seems unable to do some of the fine detail work that Carissa Savar doesn't think should be that hard. Perhaps he's lazy. Or rather, he definitely seems to be trying quite hard right now, but perhaps he's been lazy his whole previous life up until this point, and that's why he seems to have such miserable spellcraft. You'd seriously get the impression this person couldn't remotely use spell silver from a distance of even 2 feet away. What kind of third circle wizard is he?
Carissa isn't sure what the point of sending her an enchanter who is bad at enchanting is. This isn't meant to be an object lesson. It's meant to be a way to get everyone Glibness swords as soon as possible, and they're going to take 4 days each, even going at a good pace. Does giving him her armillary amulet help him see what he was doing wrong?
It helps, but it's pretty clear that this person isn't actually going to be able to create slotless/sword-based Glibness items. Without Carissa coming in here and helping like every day on the most important detail work, maybe Abigail wanted to give her an excuse for needing to take a little time every day to do some enchanting? That would be very thoughtful of the Queen. Just like her, really.
Or maybe Abigail sent her someone who sucks so she would get frustrated and torture them to death. That seems more like Abigail, actually.
He'll try even harder. But trying harder doesn't actually let you do microscopically detailed work perfectly if you're not Carissa Sevar.
Asmodeus didn't give her spellcraft powers. She just did things and then got better at doing them. He should try it. Actually, she's getting frustrated and not having fun and not making sword progress. So what he should do is watch and try to learn something while she spends the rest of the evening making Glibness swords. Which is fun, unlike trying to get people to understand things, which is terrible.
He He can do some parts of this work. He can help.
Right, but if she has to pay attention to him, then she'll be annoyed and not having fun. And she could really use some uncomplicated fun right now. So she's just going to do this and he can watch, and then on his own time, he can try to copy it and see how far he gets.
Acknowledged.
Anyway, aside from them not having been able to send her a good enchanter, this is a very refreshing break from her stressful day job.
He watches her nearly inhuman spellcraft with horrified attentiveness. He couldn't match the Chosen with 2 more wizard circles and 20 more years of practice. Couldn't make these tiny swords of glibness even if he trained for a year to make just that one item type. But he can maybe possibly if he works until exhaustion show the Chosen that he can prepare the lesser parts of her work for her. Present her with prepared materials that she'll be able to complete with 2 hours less of her time. If he works for 10 hours before then.
Pull timestamp, day 19:15, still night.
The Most High has apparently decided that Asmodia is cleared to know who Broom's god actually is. Otolmans, the god of preventing the universe's inconsistencies from destroying it, while all the other gods run around making her work harder. Oh, Aspexia Rugaton doesn't quite describe Otolmans that way, in so many words. But it's kind of obvious. Keltham must not be told this, because you don't want to go around suggesting to people that they might have the capability to destroy the universe and steer their thoughts in that direction. Keltham must be allowed to think that Broom's god just works to prevent wish spells gone awry and lesser such disasters. This also feels obvious. Asmodia had completed and predicted the thought before she even got to that section of the letter. Shielded. Otolmans couldn't possibly be her sponsor, could she? It doesn't feel, somehow, like a sort of thing that Otolmans would do. Still, if each of the special girls corresponds to some god involved in this, if that's how tropes work, then maybe Otolmans is the one that Asmodia corresponds to. Even if that doesn't make Otolmans the one who saved her in hell, and to whom Asmodia owes gratitude or fealty. Asmodia will think about it. If there's someone somewhere in all the universe who cares about her, then Asmodia wouldn't want to see that universe destroyed. Otolmia doesn't have a bad ring to it either. She'll also, after some amount of internal deliberation and review of thought transcripts, recommend Corva Talandria for a lot of Fox's cunnings tonight. Asmodia isn't sure why she's doing that, making the decision that's actually best for Cheliax. It's not in Asmodia's own personal interests to do that. It would be better for Asmodia if Corva failed out of the regular classes because she couldn't keep up with the math. That way, Asmodia could steal Corva and put her to work exclusively on the wall. Why isn't Asmodia doing that? It obviously isn't out of being good. They're all working to serve evil here. Asmodia could get away with the disloyalty. Her thoughts can't be read. Asmodia doesn't know. Well, whatever. Asmodia doesn't always need to know the reasons why she acts the way she does, right? Asmodia recommends Corva for a lot of cunning spells tonight, and files a request for a +2 intelligence headband that Corva can wear at nighttime. The project could also really use a +4 intelligence headband that people in general can pass around at nighttime, or when Keltham isn't looking. The newcomers could be that smart, for all Keltham knows, and there's not much chance of them being able to keep up otherwise. There's limits to how many enhancement spells the project's harried third circles can do, with so many more people. Project Lawful uses mental stats, the way some projects eat spell silver or gold.
Sure. Authorized. Asmodia can have a favorite among the new kids if she wants a favorite among the new kids.
Maritzel gathers around a bunch of the new students to condescendingly reteach probability, since Asmodia shouldn't be the only one doing that.
One of the new kids, who in fact looks older and scarier than Maritzel does, is going to say out loud that Maritzel could maybe use an extra eagle's splendor for purposes of making herself understood.
Well, then that one can leave, and Maritzel will teach the ones who don't object to her teaching style.
That's fucking cold. Even most of the crueler teachers don't do that.
The rest of the new kids will listen attentively.
If you wish to support this AI reading and others like it, please visit patreon.com/askwhocastsai. Any help is appreciated. And thank you to executive producer John Doe 777-6059.